Okay. Now, I want to come to begin to talk about our confession of faith. And the place to start, I want to show you just a couple of examples of how the language of the early confessions or the creeds of the church is actually incorporated into the language of our confession. And then I want to talk about the question of confessional subscription. Apologize that I have to sort this out here for a moment. If you'll take a copy of the confession, it's in the Trinity hymnal, or you may have a copy with you. Turn to chapter 8 of Christ the Mediator. There's a couple of things here that are really interesting. Now, we could look at chapter 2 of God and of the Holy Trinity, but we will be doing that in a little bit more detail later today. We won't get to chapter 8, but I'll point out one or two things for you here. If you look at paragraph 4 of chapter 8, and if you think about it in light of the Apostles' Creed, you'll find that this statement is structured in the same way that the statements about Christ in the Apostles' Creed are structured. Notice paragraph 4. This office the Lord Jesus did most willingly undertake, which that he might discharge, he was made under the law, and did perfectly fulfill it, and underwent the punishment due to us, which we should have borne and suffered, being made sin and a curse for us, enduring most grievous sorrows in his soul, and most painful sufferings in his body, was crucified and died, remained in the state of the dead, yet saw no corruption. On the third day he arose from the dead with the same body in which he suffered, in which he also ascended into heaven, and there sitteth at the right hand of his Father, making intercession, and shall return to judge men and angels at the end of the world. Now, if you're familiar with the Apostles' Creed, that's largely what the statement about the Lord Jesus says. It's expanded a little, but there are reasons why it's expanded, so that any kind of Roman Catholic or Eastern Orthodox misunderstandings are not imported into it. There are some explanations here, but it's largely the structure and the order of the statement in the Apostles' Creed. Look back at paragraph 2. This is the statement on the person of Christ. The Son of God, the second person in the Holy Trinity, being very and eternal God, the brightness of the Father's glory, of one substance and equal with him, who made the world, who upholdeth and governeth all things he hath made, did, when the fullness of time was come, take unto him man's nature, with all the essential properties and common infirmities thereof, yet without sin. Being conceived by the Holy Spirit in the womb of the Virgin Mary, the Holy Spirit coming down upon her, and the power of the Most High overshadowing her, and so was made of a woman of the tribe of Judah, of the seed of Abraham and David, according to the Scriptures, so that two whole, perfect, and distinct natures were inseparably joined together in one person, without conversion, composition, or confusion, which person is very God and very man, yet one Christ, the only mediator between God and man. Now, if we were doing a careful and thorough exposition of this paragraph, what we would do is notice that this is technical language that is taken right out of the Chalcedonian statement. This idea of two whole perfect natures, distinct natures, inseparably joined in one person, that is the most classic statement of Orthodox Christology, doctrine of the person of Christ, that you'll find anywhere. It would be familiar across the board to Christians. And then, even more precisely, without conversion, composition or confusion. Those words are taken directly from the original Greek of the Chalcedonian statement. Now, it's not that the Baptists wrote this. The Westminster Confession of Faith says exactly the same thing. You know our confession is based on Westminster. And then the Savoy Declaration of 1658 of the Congregationalists says exactly the same thing. The Baptists are identifying themselves with the mainstream of Puritan theology in the middle of the 17th century. But those Puritans are identifying themselves with this classic Catholic doctrine. And I don't mean Roman Catholic. I mean Catholic doctrine, a doctrine that has been believed by every Christian who has been considered Orthodox throughout all of the centuries. And then the final statement, which person is very God and very man, that's the language of the Athanasian Creed, which is incorporated into the confession at this place. Now, we could do a whole lot more, and we could see how the ancient creeds are incorporated, but these are maybe two of the most obvious and explicit places where our fathers saw that it was appropriate for them to bring into the language of our confession the language of these ancient creeds. And so when you confess the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed, as I know that you do, and when we confess it in our church, really what we're doing is we're reciting parts of our confession of faith that are embedded in our confession itself. All right. Now, switching gears a little bit, before we come to a discussion of the confession itself, I want to talk about confessional subscription. Now, this, for Baptists, this is a little bit of an unusual topic to discuss, because you will find that among Baptists, the notion of confessional subscription is oftentimes rejected. Some Baptists argue that Baptists have always been an anti-confessional, anti-creedal group. Now, I find it astounding that people make that claim, but it's not very difficult to find. The first time that I ever taught Baptist history, I was hired by Southern Seminary to teach it at their extension in central Massachusetts. And this would have been 1995 or so. And I went over there to their extension location and talked to the man who's in charge, not really the dean, but the director for the extension center. And they have just a little bookstore. And they had a large selection of a particular book on Baptist history that had been written by Leon Macbeth, a professor. Now he's retired, but he had been a professor at Southwestern Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas. That's, you know, the Southern Baptists have six official seminaries, and Southwestern at that time was their largest one. And Macbeth had written this book on Baptist history. It's about 800 pages long. It's really impressive in terms of being comprehensive. And Ernie Beavers, who was the director of the center there, asked me to use this as the textbook for my Baptist history course because they had them sitting there in their bookstore and they wanted to get rid of them. And I hadn't read it before, and since it was a Southern Baptist seminary and a Southern Baptist textbook, and I didn't know any better, I said, okay. And then I went home and read the book after I had already agreed to use it. And I was really troubled by it. On the one hand, it was a very useful textbook. And one way that I put it is I say that it's about the only comprehensive textbook on Baptist history that you'll find. And what I mean by that is it largely covers everything carefully from the at least from the 17th century until today. Doesn't have a great deal of information about Baptists around the world. That's a deficiency that every Baptist history textbook has. But still, in terms of Europe or England and North America, and the development of missions and things like that. It's very good. But on the other hand, Macbeth wrote the book in the midst of the controversy that had erupted in the Southern Baptist Convention over the place of the Bible. Now, this is not the time to get into a lot of Southern Baptist history, but you may know that the 20th century was not very kind to Southern Baptists. They expanded enormously, but most of their leadership adopted a kind of liberal theology. All of their seminaries had gone over to promoting liberal theology in various kinds. And there was, starting in the 1970s, a movement to restore conservative theology to the Southern Baptist Convention. It started with W.A. Criswell and a couple of other men in Dallas, Texas. And they realized that they could recover the convention and restore doctrines like the inspiration of Scripture, the inerrancy of Scripture, to the confession through using the political process in the convention. And basically it works like this. The president, the man who's elected to be president of the Southern Baptist Convention, as I understand it, appoints the Committee on Committees, which is the most important committee at the top level of the convention. And that Committee on Committees then has the responsibility of filling the seats in the other committees in the convention. And they realized that if they could, over the years, elect conservative presidents who would commit themselves to replacing liberals on the Committee of Committees with conservatives, that over the course of years, they could, from the top down, change the theological structure of the Southern Baptist Convention. And they did it. They were successful. So that today, largely, the Southern Baptist Convention is far more conservative than it would have been 30 years ago. It was a successful political strategy. But in the midst of that, while that's going on, the liberals were very, very unhappy. And you had a battle going. And Leon Macbeth represented more of the liberal side of the Southern Baptist Convention. Now, the conservatives argued that they needed to have some kind of creed in order to maintain orthodoxy in the convention. And they ended up, they adopted a document called the Baptist Faith and Message. But the liberals in the Southern Baptist Convention didn't want any creed. And Macbeth wrote this 800-page history, it's called the Baptist Heritage. He wrote it to say Baptists have never been a creedal people. He doesn't come out and say, and so we shouldn't adopt one now in the Southern Baptist Convention, but that's the agenda that he had in writing that book. And I remember as I read through it, I said to myself, this guy has an axe to grind, and he's constantly grinding that axe all the way through. Now, it simply isn't true. All you have to do is pick up the book by William Lumpkin, who interestingly himself was affiliated with the liberal side of the Southern Baptist Convention, but he published a big fat book called Baptist Confessions of Faith, in which he shows that Baptists have a long history of careful, thorough confessions of faith that go all the way back to the first General Baptist in 1612. Now, those anti-confessional voices who have argued that the core identity of the Baptist cause has been freedom. See, that's their point, freedom. As soon as you adopt a creed, you impose upon someone's freedom. And the core identity is freedom. We have to assert that everybody is at liberty, that everybody has rights, and we can't impose anything upon them. Well, nobody's arguing for imposing. We're talking about adopting and submitting ourselves freely to something that comes to us. But they have been so vocal in their publication of literature against creeds that you'll find it's very difficult to find positive statements about confessionalism from Baptists. Now, the more conservative side in the Southern Baptist Convention realized this, and they did begin to develop literature that argued for creedalism. I sat in on a meeting a couple of years ago where Al Mohler was one of the speakers. Dr. Mohler is president of Southern Seminary. in Louisville, Kentucky, and he was arguing for confessionalism there. Many of the more conservative men in the Southern Baptist Convention have moved in the direction of confessionalism, although we could wish that they might go a little bit further. So it's difficult to find literature from a Baptist perspective on this. A lot of the stuff that I've had to put together is not so much Baptist stuff, but from Presbyterianism. But it still makes the point. Okay. Now, what I want to do is walk through with you some categories of confessional subscription. Now, what does the word subscription mean? It means that we sign our names, either literally or by a verbal commitment, to whatever the document happens to be and say, this is what we believe. And what do we mean when we say, this is what we believe? This is how I adopt this creed or this confession. What do we mean by that? Well, people have approached this in different ways over the years. And I have 9 categories of subscription that I want to present to you, to talk about with you, and then talk about what we have adopted as our approach. I know that your church has, our association of churches has. I have adopted this personally. Your pastor, as one of the trustees of the Institute of Reformed Baptist Studies, signs off annually on this. We'll talk about that. All right, so here we go. 9 levels of confessional subscription. The first of them is what I call... doctrine divides, love unites. Now this, in a sense, is a rejection of confessional subscription. Because people who use this approach say, as soon as you start to talk about doctrine, you set up boundaries, you build walls, and you divide people. And what we really need is love. I like to call this Rodney King subscriptionism. Why can't we all just get along? Well, you see, what happens is doctrine is pitted against relation. And the core value for Christianity becomes love. But I ask the question, how can love properly exist without some kind of categories? You know, perhaps not a very good illustration of this, but I think one that makes the point is the attacks that are being made on marriage today. And I'm not even thinking about gay marriage. I'm just thinking about people who don't bother to be married anymore, who live together and have children and have a family, but never make any kind of formal commitment to each other. They say that they do that on the basis of love, but it's not really love, is it? If you're unwilling to make a commitment to that person, if you're unwilling to formally become a family and demonstrate what it means to be a husband who will watch out for his wife all of her life and all of his life, what do you have? You have nothing. And that's what is happening in our society today. Divorce rates are going up. The divorce rate for second divorces is higher than the divorce rate for first divorces, meaning people who get one are more likely to get the second one. We see a breakdown in society, all of it because love, an undefined kind of love, has become a central value in Western society, apart from any recognition that we need to have standards, that we need to have laws that define certain things. And our society is moving further and further in that direction. Well, this has happened in the church as well. And doctrine divides, love unites, says we don't need confessions, we shouldn't subscribe to confessions, because all that we need to get along with each other is love. The Beatles sang, all you need is love, and then they broke up. Well, that's the way that this tends to work. Now, what I'm doing is I'm moving from the loosest views of subscription to the tightest views of subscription. The second view that I want to talk about is what I call Bible sufficiency subscription. Bible sufficiency subscription. Now this category is usually stated in some kind of terms like this. We hold to the Bible alone. It's sufficient for us. Confessions are man-made documents. And this has appeared in the history of the church in two ways. Let me try to explain them for you. The first of them, the first way that this has been used is by men who want to promote unbelief and who don't like the categories that are introduced by confessions or creeds. Let me give you two examples. One a little bit older, one a little bit more recent. In 1719 in England, a series of debates were held out in the towns away from London. And the question that was addressed was, is it necessary for a minister to maintain his position as a pastor of a Christian church to subscribe to the doctrine of the Trinity or not? Is it necessary? Now, see, what was happening in 1719, this is the beginning of what we call the Enlightenment, where Western society was moving away from an agreement that was largely Christian and was rejecting any kind of supernaturalism or supernatural revelation and beginning to develop a philosophy that said that man by himself is sufficient to govern life, to understand the world around him, to promote society. And there's a movement away from Christianity in France, in Italy, and for our purposes, in England. And it profoundly affected English Christians as well. The doctrine of the Trinity was being attacked. They said that it was a man-made production, that the word Trinity isn't found in the Bible. We don't need that doctrine. And so there was a movement to reject the doctrine of the Trinity. And the way that it was approached was to say, literally, no human compositions or interpretations of the doctrine of the Trinity should be part of the requirements for ministerial service. A debate was held in London, finally, to try to resolve this. Now, there were four denominations who were present, not the Church of England. This was the churches outside of the Church of England. The English Presbyterians, the English Congregationalists, the General Baptists or the Arminian Baptists, and the Particular Baptists. They had representatives from those four groups who were present at this debate at Salter's Hall in London in 1719. The debate was held, and at the end of the debate, the question was called, and the delegates who were present were asked to give their opinion. A slim majority of them agreed that it was not necessary for a minister to subscribe to the doctrine of the Trinity in order to maintain his ministerial service. Now, interestingly, the majority of those who agreed with that proposal were from the English Presbyterians and the General Baptists. Okay? Remember, there were four groups present. Congregationalists, Particular Baptists, General Baptists, and English Presbyterians. The majority of the Presbyterians and the General Baptists said, don't need to subscribe to a Trinitarian doctrine. The majority of the Congregationalists and the Particular Baptists said, yes, you do. Well, the result of the Salter's Hall debates was the death of two English denominations, because the English Presbyterianism died at that point. You know, we think of the Westminster Confession as a Presbyterian document, right? And it was written in England by Englishmen. And yet, Presbyterianism that we know in America today is really Scottish. It has come to us through the emigration of people from Scotland. There is really no English Presbyterian church today. There are attempts being made to plant some Presbyterian churches in England, but they died. And the reason that they died is they rejected the doctrine of the Trinity, headed off into liberalism, and died. The same with the General Baptists. They very quickly went down the road of unbelief, and there continued to be General Baptists, but they actually called themselves the New Connection of General Baptists because they had a completely separate and different beginning. And many of them refused to join in with the older group of General Baptists because of their liberalism. Both of those groups, the English Presbyterians and the General Baptists, became Unitarian and lost any sense of biblical Christianity. But you see, the argument was, a creed is a man-made document, and ministers must not be required to subscribe to a man-made document. The second illustration, which comes a little bit more to home, is from American Baptist history, really Northern Baptist history. In 1922, at the meeting of the Northern Baptist Convention, W.B. Riley, who was the pastor of First Baptist Minneapolis and a conservative, proposed to the Northern Baptist Convention the adoption of the New Hampshire Confession of Faith as a standard for the churches and the ministers in the Northern Baptist Convention. Now, 1922 is at the height of the fundamentalist controversy. You have a wing of the Northern Baptists who want to do away with conservative theology, with the Bible, with the resurrection, with the virgin birth, and you have a wing that wants to hold on to those things. And W.B. Riley, to his credit, proposed the adoption of the New Hampshire Confession. Now, the New Hampshire Confession is a fairly brief but very good statement of Orthodox Christianity. He proposed this in 1922, hoping that the convention would adopt it and it would become a standard for the Northern Baptists to judge missionaries, to judge ministers, for their seminaries, all of the mechanism of the convention. An opponent of this, who was from Park Avenue Baptist Church in New York. Now, that's right in Manhattan. That was a society church. Did you know that the Rockefellers were Baptists? And a lot of Rockefeller money was given to liberalizing Baptist causes. The University of Chicago, for example, was originally a Baptist school that was funded by the Rockefellers. And the Rockefellers attended Park Avenue Baptist Church. Well, the pastor of that church, who had what I think was an appropriate name, his name was Cornelius Wolfkin. He stood up at the 1922 Northern Baptist Convention in opposition to W.B. Riley. And he made this proposal of a resolution. He said, "The Northern Baptist Convention affirms that the New Testament is an all-sufficient ground for Baptist faith and practice, and they need no other statement." Now, the records tell us that there were 3 hours of heated debate. But finally, when the question was called, Wolfkin's motion was passed by a 2-to-1 margin. Now, I think the way that we could put it is this. While the Bible won, the Bible really lost. Because this was a spiritual-sounding ploy to promote liberal theology under the guise of Christian freedom. That's what it was. Wolfkin was a representative of the liberalizing wing of the Northern Baptist Convention, and they did not want to be subject to the boundaries that the New Hampshire Confession would impose upon them. They said, no, we can't have that. Well, the result in the long term, as we know, is that the Northern Baptist Convention very quickly was lost to any kind of conservative theology. All of its seminaries, every single one, went the way of liberalism. And there's nowadays, the Northern Baptist Convention is called the American Baptist Churches USA, and it's one of the most liberal denominations that you'll find anywhere in the United States of America. And it's because of not simply this action in 1922, but that action in 1922 is an example of what happens when people promote the Bible naively, or even as a ploy to avoid commitment to doctrinal categories. Now, there's another way in which this category is found in the history of the church, and you'll find this sometimes in conservative and evangelical churches, especially a lot of times churches that want to steer clear of denominational categories. They like the name Bible church or community church or something like that. And I'm not saying that this is true of every Bible church or community church, okay? I'm not saying that. We have churches in ARBCA that don't have the name Baptist in their name, the word Baptist. So please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. But there are a lot of churches who just don't want to be identified with any kind of denominational structure. And they refuse to adopt any kind of doctrinal statement asserting that the New Testament alone is their standard. I know of one church in Dallas, Texas, for example. They were called before a court of law. Well, it was the IRS that they were brought before. And they were asked to produce what they believed. And they submitted a Bible as the definition of what they believed. Now, one of the problems with this is, and while I appreciate the desire of these evangelical churches to give to the Bible its proper place, and of course the Bible always is of greater importance than any kind of confession of faith. One of the problems is that these churches do have doctrinal statements. A lot of times they're unwritten, but they're just as real as the written doctrinal statement that you and I have in our churches. If we went to visit them, if I preached there, or if you went and began to probe a little bit and ask some questions, you'll find out that though they say the Bible alone is their standard of doctrine, they really have a carefully defined doctrinal system that all of their ministers and members must subscribe to. And if you start to challenge it in any way, explosions will come as a result. So they have an unwritten code, but they still have that code nonetheless. You see, the appeal to the Bible sounds spiritual, but it cannot be sustained in practice. Interpretation and the resulting system is inevitable. All right. My problem here is that I'm working backwards with my notes. And so I have to figure out what's next. It's not what's at the top of the page, it's what's at the bottom of the page. And I need to read up. And that's why I'm struggling right here. The next category is what I call substance of doctrine subscription. Substance of doctrine subscription. Now what this category means is this. Churches or ministers subscribe to a confession as that confession reflects the gospel or the gospel is understood by that fellowship, but nothing beyond that is required. And so they agree to allow differences on a broad range of subjects because they share the same core of beliefs. So they're committed to the core, but the rest is really irrelevant. Now we have a really good example of this from American Baptist history, and it goes like this. In 1787, the records of the Philadelphia Association record one letter that they received from John Leland. Now, John Leland was the leader of the Baptists in Virginia. And in Virginia, there were two different Baptist groups. We call them the regulars and the separates. Now let me explain to you just for a moment what these two groups were. The regulars are what you might call the older, established Baptist churches in the cities who would have, in their history, they would have adopted and held to the Philadelphia Confession, which is basically the same as, our Second London Confession of Faith. The separates were Baptist churches that came into existence as a result of the revival, the Great Awakening. You might know that the greatest beneficiaries of the Great Awakening on the eastern seaboard of the U.S. were the Baptists. In New England, the Baptists went from having about 75 churches to having over 500 churches in the course of about 80 years as a result of the Great Awakening. And that was true. Those kind of statistics were true all the way down the East Coast. Now these separates often came out of older congregational or Presbyterian churches. They were a result of people hearing the preachers in the revivals being converted, being unsatisfied with the kind of lukewarm religion that had been present in their churches before. And because they weren't happy with this lukewarm kind of preaching, they formed their own new churches. They formed them around the Bible. They read the Bible carefully and they said, we can't find infant baptism in here. Let's practice believer's baptism. And so they were called separates. Now, they were a little bit more enthusiastic. They tended not to have ministers who had formal training. And they tended to be out in the countryside, where the regulars tended to be in the towns and in the cities. And Leland was identified with the separates, but they didn't want to be separate from their brothers and sisters in the Baptist churches among the regulars. And so Leland tried to find a way where he could bring these two groups of Baptists together. And they wrote up what they called a plan of union that would bring together the regulars, the older churches, and the separates, the newer revivalistic churches, together into one association of churches. And that plan of union is reprinted for us in the Philadelphia Records, and it says this. After a long debate about the utility of adopting a confession of faith, it was agreed to receive the regular Baptists. Now, I presume that that means that they agreed that they would adopt the confession of the regular Baptists, which would have been the Philadelphia Confession. But then notice what he says next. But to prevent its usurping a tyrannical power over the consciences of any, we do not mean that every person is to be bound to the strict observance of everything therein contained, yet that it holds forth the essential truths of the gospel, and that the doctrine of salvation by Christ and free unmerited grace alone ought to be believed by every Christian and maintained by every minister of the gospel. Now, you see, what had happened was Virginia was an Anglican colony. It had a state church. And that state church was the Church of England. And the Church of England was a persecuting church against everyone who refused to submit to it. And they imposed the creeds of the Anglican church upon, or they attempted to impose the creeds of the Anglican church upon all of the Christians in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Leland saw that, and he came to the conclusion that to adopt a confession of faith was actually to adopt, to impose upon believers something that was illegitimate. And so he had this sort of deep-seated opposition to the notion that we should adopt confessions of faith. And so he proposed that the Virginia Baptists simply use this kind of loose subscription. Now, what happened was that was the beginning of the decline of Baptist theology in Virginia. So far as Leland was concerned, to adopt a confession only involved a commitment to the essential truths of the gospel contained in the document, not to the details. And really, that was the beginning of broad evangelicalism in Virginia. Now, you see, in a sense, you have to ask the question, well, what are the essential truths of the gospel, John? What do you mean, Mr. Leland, when you say we submit to those? Those have to be identified, don't they? But apparently that is supposed to be somewhat straightforward and simple. All right. Now, if I'm reading my notes correctly, the next category is what I call loose or system subscription. Now, we're getting tighter as we move forward. I don't really like the phrase loose subscription because I think that it implies something that's not present. Now, this view advocates a position of general agreement with a confessional document with more or less concern for details. Morton Smith says, loose or system subscription maintains that we subscribe to a system of doctrine which is not specifically defined but which is contained in the confession. The system subscriptionist maintains that only the doctrines comprising the system are mandated in the subscription. Doctrines that are not a part of the system are not included. Now, this is a Presbyterian approach. And among the Presbyterians, when they use this approach to confessional subscription, they are willing to deny certain truths that they think are not essential, but they agree with the rest of the doctrines of their confession. Now, the reason that I don't like the phrase loose is I heard a debate many years ago at Westminster Seminary between Morton Smith and William, he taught church history at Westminster in Philadelphia. Bill Edgar, don't think it was him. I guess it doesn't matter. But as I listened to this fellow speak, his objections were really minor. And I realized that to him, the system of doctrine contained in the Westminster Confession was actually quite extensive. And so it is a view of commitment to a confession of faith that that is fairly extensive. And when it's properly applied, only allows a few objections here and there. The fifth category of subscription is the one that has been adopted by the Presbyterian Church of America, and it's called good faith subscription. Now, good faith subscription basically asserts that each presbytery has the right to determine for itself how much or how little of the confession of faith will be adopted. Now, I suppose that this probably couldn't work in a Baptist situation where we don't have presbyteries that examine candidates for ministry and that rule over local churches. But it's important to notice it along the way. We won't spend a lot of time on it. But it has become the official doctrine of the Presbyterian Church of America, which is one of the largest conservative Presbyterian denominations in our country. The next category of subscription is defined by a Latin phrase, animus imponentis. And what that means is the spirit of the imposing body. Now, this again is a Presbyterian approach to subscription to a confession of faith. And the idea is this. The church, the Presbyterian church, has a right to determine how its confession of faith will be understood, and everyone who is part of the church then must understand that confession in that way. Now, what this means is the church has the right to reinterpret phrases or parts of the confession that in a way that differs from what was the intent of the originators or even the historical understanding of that doctrine, so that today what the church believes using the same words may be different from those who went before. The Orthodox Presbyterian Church, I don't know if they have formally adopted this view of subscription, but many of the men in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church have been arguing for adopting this so that the church itself becomes the body that defines what the doctrine is in the church. All right, the next category, I'm rushing here because I'm technically already out of time. The next category is the one that we have adopted in our association of churches, which we call full subscription. Full subscription is a view of the confession of faith that says we adopt all of the doctrines that are contained in the confession of faith, although we don't necessarily adopt every word that is in the confession of faith. Let me give you an example. If you have your confession in front of you, take a look at chapter 2. Paragraph 3. Now, if you take a look at this, chapter 2, paragraph 3, I said before that our confession is a version of the Westminster Confession. You could even call it a baptized Westminster Confession. The language of the Westminster Confession in chapter 2, paragraph 3, it begins like this. In the unity of the Godhead, there be three persons of one substance, power, and eternity. Our confession alters that language. In this divine and infinite being, there are three subsistences, the Father, the Word, or Son, and Holy Spirit, of one substance, power, and eternity. Now, someone might come along and say, I don't have any quibbles with the doctrine of the Trinity as it's presented in the Confession of Faith. But I wish that they hadn't changed that language there and left it in the way that Westminster did. In the unity of the Godhead, there be three persons. Ours, in this divine and infinite being, there are three subsistences. Now, we don't have the time here to talk about the technical reasons why our confession uses the word subsistence and the Westminster Confession uses the word persons. It's actually a long technical discussion. And it's very interesting and fascinating, but we don't have time to do it today. But maybe you would say, you know, I really wish that they had left it alone as persons. That's not unorthodox. In many ways, it doesn't say anything different. And so you'd say, I agree with the doctrine, but I wish that the language had been left persons rather than subsistences. You still are fully subscribing to the confession at that point. You're just saying, I wish this word had not been changed. That's our view. We subscribe to every doctrine, although we don't subscribe to every single word, and we allow people the freedom to prefer words in one way or another. All right, two more categories, and then we'll take our long break for the morning. The next one is what I call historical subscription. Now remember, we're moving from loose to tight. The next two are pretty tight. Historical subscription says that we must understand a confession of faith not just in terms of the doctrines that it contains and the intention of the authors, but also in terms of the sort of the historical and philosophical backgrounds that are present in the writing or that were present when the confession was being written. A good example of this, John Gerstner, some of you know, was R.C. Sproul's mentor. And Dr. Gerstner didn't like the kind of Christian apologetics that were being promoted by Cornelius Van Til at Westminster Seminary, a view called presuppositionalism. Dr. Gerstner argued that that was a new development in Christian theology that would have been not recognized by those who went before. And he argued for what he called classical apologetics. And he took it one step further and stated, at least I've been told that he stated, that you couldn't really hold the Westminster Confession of Faith in a strict sense because the Westminster Puritans would not have agreed with Cornelius Van Til. They would have held this classical approach to apologetics. And so he was basically saying that many modern Presbyterians are outside of the stream of historic Presbyterianism in their subscription to the confession. There are other examples that we could give. I was reading on my way over on the plane yesterday a book that is investigating some of the medical background of the 17th century. It's actually a book on John Bunyan and the Pilgrim's Progress and his use of medical imagery in the Pilgrim's Progress. And I was thinking about the fact that a lot of what Bunyan puts together in the Pilgrim's Progress was governed by the sort of medieval view of who we are as individuals psychologically and of medieval medicine. Early Western medicine is just beginning to develop at that time. And I realize that there may be things in the confession that are influenced by those medieval views of psychology and medicine. And we don't have to accept that background material. It's not the philosophies. It's not the way that they approach history. Another example would be in terms of prophecy of the future, of God's purpose for the end of the world. All of them would have been committed to a view of eschatology that we call historicism. That is, that the book of Revelation was given to John and given to the church as something of a preview of what church history would be. Everybody believed that until about the 19th century. Today, hardly anyone believes that anymore. Are we, by adopting the confession, are we committing ourselves to that historicist view of eschatology? No, not at all. But that would be historical subscription. It says all of these things that are going on in the background are also implied in our commitments. The final category is what I call absolute subscription or jot and tittle subscription. And this is the view that insists that the only consistent position to maintain is absolute agreement with every phrase or word contained in a confessional document. Of course, I think that that's totally unworkable because it ultimately creates churches of one. My opinion and what I see and how I interpret this confession in this way. There's no way that I think we should advocate absolute subscription. There are some churches that try to do it, though. There's a group in another country that I know of. They're Presbyterians, and they have such a strict view of the Westminster Confession at the Westminster Assembly in the 1640s, they produced several pieces of theological literature. Confession of Faith, Shorter Catechism, Larger Catechism, we're familiar with those things. They produced something called the Sum of Saving Knowledge. They produced something called the Directory for Public Worship. And in this Presbyterian denomination, they adopt all of those things. Now, what's really interesting, at the end of the Directory for Public Worship, there's a couple of paragraphs on the singing of psalms. And one of the things that is noted in these directions on the singing of psalms is that you are to have a precentor. Now, the precentor is the guy who does what Leroy did for us this morning and starts the psalm. But in their day, no one had hymnals or psalters. And so the precentor would what's called line out the psalm. That is, he would sing the first line, and then the people would repeat it, and then he would sing the second line, and the people would repeat it, and the third line, and the people would, and the fourth, and you have this sing-song back and forth in which that's how you know what you are to sing because you hear it from the precentor. Okay? All people that on earth do dwell. Leroy would sing it, and then we as the congregation would respond, and we would go back and forth. And in the Directory for Public Worship, in the singing of psalms, because they didn't have psalters to hold in their hands, and many of the people would have been illiterate, that's the practice that they recommend. Well, this denomination says that's the only way that you can sing the psalms, you see, by lining them out. And if you do anything else, you violate the principles of the confession. That's absolute subscription, and I think it's nonsense. It just doesn't work. All right? Now, we are actually past the time that we were supposed to stop for a break, but probably you have some questions. And so if you don't mind, I think it would be best for us to do questions now and then take a break rather than do it the other way around.